This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Donna Adelson from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Please raise your right hand.
Good morning.
Do you swear or affirm the testimony you will give today will be the truth?
I do.
You may take your seat.
Thank you.
You may examine when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you please introduce yourself to the jury?
I'm Kristen Adamson.
Hey, Ms. Adamson, how are you employed?
I'm a lawyer.
What type of law do you practice?
I practice family law, and I have done so for 37 years.
How long have you been practicing?
37 years.
Okay. Are you board certified?
Yes, I am board certified in marriage and family law by the Florida Supreme Court.
What's involved in becoming board certified?
I've been board certified since 1996. I had to take a test on family law, and I had to pass a peer review by judges and my colleagues in the Florida Bar Family Law Section. I have to recertify every 5 years, so I've had to also do that every 5 years. I'm coming up, I think, 2026, I will be in my thing again. Well, I'll have to recertify.
Have you received any other accolades or awards throughout your career for your work in family law?
I was heavily involved in the Florida Bar Family Law Section on the Executive Council for a long time. I am a fellow in the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, past president of the Florida chapter. And I am a fellow in the International Academy of Family Law Lawyers as well. All of those required board certification prior to being allowed to be a fellow, as well as another test nationally and locally, and written tests and oral tests as well.
And how long have you been a member or a fellow of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers?
I have been a fellow since 2020, and I was president in 2012.
How long have you been a fellow in the International Academy of Family Lawyers?
Approximately 5 years.
In your work as a family law attorney, did you have occasion to represent Wendy Adelson?
I did represent Wendy Adelson in the end of 2012, I believe it was, 2013, and part of 2014.
Would you call her divorce a bitter custody battle?
I would not. That's not how I would characterize it.
How would you characterize it?
She had a relocation case where she desired to go to Miami. All relocation cases are a little bit more difficult than just regular custody cases because we almost always have to have a court determination on a relocation case because, unlike almost all other family law cases, relocation is a win-lose thing. Almost everything else in family law is sort of a split the baby. Relocation is not. So we did have to go to court on that. And that going to court always is a little bit harder. But in general, this was more or less after that a run-of-the-mill kind of parenting issue kind of case.
Is it unusual to seek, in your practice, has it been unusual to seek relocation?
No, not at all. I have two right now.
Now, speaking to Tallahassee, why is it not unusual?
Why is it not unusual?
Yes.
It's not unusual because it depends on why someone is here in Tallahassee. Tallahassee has a lot of students with the university. They may graduate with a degree, have children, expect to be able to move somewhere else after they graduate. One person wants to leave, the other person doesn't want to leave. The two cases I have right now, that I'm not here in front of this court, so they're actually, one of them settled. One of them, the mother received a potential job offer in North Carolina. The father lived here. She wanted to move to North Carolina. All of his family was here. Her family was not. She wanted to move somewhere else, so that was one. And another one that I have right now is a person wants to move to Pensacola. My client wants to move to Pensacola because her family is there. And the father does not want to because his job is here. So it's almost always about moving to be close to your family when a marriage dissolves. I mean, that even happened with my sister when she divorced in Florida. She moved to Atlanta to being close to my parents. It's a very common thing for people to want to move to be near their parents, no matter how old they are.
Now, do you have parents who attend client meetings?
I do. And it doesn't seem to matter whether my clients are 20 or 40. I have many cases where a mom or a dad or sister or somebody comes to almost every meeting I have, including mediations, and they're heavily involved in the divorce of their sibling or their child, regardless of age. It's just something, families tend to be enmeshed in their other families' divorces, they do. I usually let them come to mediation because sometimes it's important to hear how the mediation is going so that they don't try to armchair quarterback it after the mediation.
Understood. Now, you indicated that you typically have to go to court for relocation. How difficult is it to get court approval for relocation?
Well, I always tell my clients in Leon County, that even though, according to the statute, there's no presumption that someone should be able to leave or not leave, I do think that there's a presumption against relocation. And I always tell my clients that it's a very hard thing to obtain a relocation. That you have to have kind of special circumstances, and there's a whole laundry list of statutory criteria that you have to meet to try to be able to relocate. And so we sit down and we go through the statutory criteria and determine whether or not you'll be able to do it. Most of the time, I tell them it's a 50-50 shot at best. Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes less.
Okay. Did you have that conversation with Wendy Adelson while you were representing her?
I did.
Okay. And did you advise her of that same information?
I did. Basically, I told her that if this is something that was important to her, this was her one shot at it. If you get divorced and then try to relocate afterwards, you're probably not going to win unless something really substantial comes up and changes it. So if she wanted to try to be able to relocate, this was her shot at it at best.
So in other words, is it not that it's easy, but is it easier to try to obtain relocation in the initial proceeding or in a modification?
In an initial proceeding.
Now, the standard for a modification, what is that?
The standard for a modification is a substantial change in circumstance. And at the time that I had Wendy's case, there was also another component, which no longer exists. But at the time that I had Wendy's case, you had to prove there was a substantial change in circumstances, that it was in the best interest of the child for a modification, and that it was detrimental to the child not to modify. That detriment part does no longer exist. Now you have to just prove there's been a substantial change in circumstance and that it's in the best interest of the children. But at that point, you would have had to prove that it was detrimental in some way to the children to modify.
Is that why you advised Ms. Wendy Adelson, if she wanted to try relocation, she should do it at the front end?
Yes. Proving detriment is hard to describe to clients because they don't understand how substantial that really has to be. It has to be very substantial. Children are failing in school, children are potentially being neglected or abused, or there's alcohol or drug or mental illness.
Okay. Have you ever been successful in convincing a judge to grant relocation?
I personally I've only won one case in 37 years for relocation.
So, would you say it's difficult?
I think it's difficult.
Okay. Now, even though you've only gotten court approval for one with a client, have you been able to successfully negotiate for relocation in other cases?
I have been able to negotiate relocation in other cases, sometimes through help of mental health professionals who will interview the parties and the children and make recommendations. Sometimes we'll have a guardian ad litem appointed to make a recommendation. We'll have a parenting evaluation or something like that that makes a recommendation. And if you have those things behind you, then it does help, because most people don't want to go to a judge if you have a mental health professional that says, oh yeah, relocation would be great. So we have been able to do it in that way. I also have been able to have relocations when you have an older child who really wants to relocate and the other parent doesn't object. Or sometimes you have, like in my sister's case, which I actually shouldn't have, but I did represent my sister. She moved to Atlanta, and then her husband was able to obtain a job in Atlanta and move up there to her former husband. So we negotiated all those things.
And I think you said you explained all of this to Wendy.
I did.
Was she aware that the chances of success were low?
Yes. I mean, I told her that this was her shot. I thought she had some good reasons. I would never have someone file a relocation if I didn't think they had a shot at it. So I think she did have a shot at it for many reasons. But including the fact that her parents were down there, that Professor Markell had a very flexible job. He had family in South Florida. These were very little children at the time. We did not have the presumption of 50-50 parenting, and she had done most of the parenting. There were lots of reasons I felt like she had a really pretty good shot at it. But I did tell her, it's not going to be easy.
Okay. Now, let's talk about family law rules of procedure generally. Do the rules require the exchange of certain materials in dissolution proceedings?
Yes.
And what are those?
We have mandatory disclosure in divorce and modification proceedings, including custody and just regular divorce. And pursuant to the Florida Supreme Court rules and 12.540, we have to file a financial affidavit under oath that the parties and lawyers and their paralegals help them fill out. We also have to provide a laundry list of documents that keeps getting larger. It's bank statements for 3 years. It's retirement statements. It's deeds. It is credit reports. I mean, it's a very large, voluminous amount of documentation that we have to exchange with the other party, the other counsel.
And when completing the financial affidavits, specifically when you completed Miss Adelson's family law financial affidavit, did you gather records in the process of completing that so you could disclose everything appropriately?
We did. We gathered all those records and we exchanged them and gave them to opposing counsel. Sometimes what does happen is the other side has all the records. For example, tax returns, we have to exchange tax returns for 3 years. Sometimes the father or the husband might have all the tax returns, the wife might have all the tax returns. So you do rely sometimes for the other side to provide the documents that you should have. But
now,
that does happen.
Do you have to list all assets on the financial affidavit?
Within reason, you do have to list your substantial assets. Sometimes I have people that want to list minutia assets, de minimis assets. We don't really do that. We try to keep it as global as possible. We don't list everybody's clothing or, you know, but we list all the cars, generally speaking. But financial affidavits are also a work in progress. We can amend them. And that is part of what happens when you go through a dissolution. Sometimes more documents come to light. A lot of times when people are getting divorced, they're not always in their best mind, and they're not always working as well as you'd want them to. So it takes a lot of help to get a lot of these documents sometimes. So we amend financial affidavits, and I always tell them, don't worry, we'll amend before we go to court. If we have more documents that come up or we find out more information or you change jobs, we have to do that.
What about non-marital assets?
We generally list non-marital assets as separate if we have knowledge of them. Non-marital assets can be very clean, where you absolutely know something's non-marital, or they may not be, because what people don't always understand, it's an education process as you're educating your client as they're going through divorce. Simply because it's in your name alone does not mean it's non-marital. So it can be in your name alone and still be marital if you have obtained it during the marriage. However, sometimes it can be both, and we have to separate things out. I know with Wendy's case, that was one of the things that happened, is she had an asset that was potentially marital and non-marital because she owned some of it before the marriage, and then she had some of it, she contributed some of it after the marriage. So it's hard to determine how much initially, and we sometimes have to hire expert witnesses, financial witnesses, to come and help us determine what part of this is non-marital and what part is marital. For example, if you have a retirement account and you've contributed to that retirement account before the marriage, everything you contributed before the marriage is yours. It's not marital. And whatever increase in value due to the market is also non-marital. So if you have $100,000 in a retirement account, you get married, that $100,000 theoretically, except for 2009, that $100,000 continues to grow, so you're entitled to the growth on it too as non-marital. So that's why sometimes it gets very complicated and we can't determine it initially when doing a financial affidavit, but we do try to determine it by the time we get to court at least.
Now, I want to back up a little bit. What happened with Wendy Adelson's relocation?
She did not win her relocation.
Can you tell us what happened at that hearing?
So we had a hearing on the relocation. We put on Wendy Adelson, and she testified about the reasons that she wanted to move. She did have a job offer in Miami. We put on the lawyer from the law firm that had offered her the job. He testified about what the job would be, how much more money she would be making, and the flexible hours, et cetera, et cetera. We put on all of that, and then at the end of our testimony, the judge asked to speak to counsel, which happens a lot, and she took counsel out. It was me and Professor Markell's lawyer, and she told us she understood why Ms. Adelson wanted to move, but she wasn't going to allow it because she didn't think she had met her burden of proving it was in the best interest of the children.
During that hearing, or after the judge made those comments, did Wendy go out in the hallway to speak to her parents?
Well, after she made those comments, I went to Mr. Duggar and I went to our respective clients. We told our respective clients what the judge had said. And basically, if the judge had already determined this without hearing from Professor Markell, we didn't really have a chance of winning this at all because she'd already heard the best case of our case. So I talked to Wendy about that, and then Wendy's parents were there, and I actually spoke to Wendy and her parents, and then she went and spoke to her parents again, I think, if I can remember. It was a long time ago, but I think she spoke to her parents outside of my presence as well.
Did Wendy ultimately stipulate to the withdrawal or the denial of that petition with prejudice?
So what happened at that point was we went back into court. The judge denied Professor Markell's motion to dismiss because he had filed a motion to dismiss our pleading. She found our pleading to be sufficient, so she entered an order denying his motion to dismiss. She entered an order that we stipulated on the records that we would agree to the denial of the relocation. And then she entered another order where we all stood there and worked through with the judge what the temporary visitation would be for the next summer and the next several months before we got to another agreement.
And at this point in time, I believe it was approximately the third week of June of 2013?
Yes.
Okay. And what was Wendy's reaction?
At that point in time, I think she was upset that she wasn't going to. I mean, nobody wants to not win their case. She was upset. She was always calm during all of my meetings with her. She understood. She's a lawyer. She understood what I was telling her in terms of the legal ramifications. I think she was resigned to it. We did speak a few times after that because we had to get geared up for the next round of this. We had already gone to a mediation before that, and we had not been able to agree at the mediation on the relocation. So we knew we had to go to another mediation. So I talked to her several times about the next mediation, which would be dealing with all the other parenting issues. And the financial issues. So I did talk to her quite a bit after that, and she seemed resigned to it.
Now, although the court denied the petition, would it have been possible for Wendy Adelson to offer Mr. Markell any financial incentive in order to convince him to change his mind?
Well, we hadn't finished the case. We still were going to go to another mediation. It's always possible. I tell everyone that even after an unsuccessful mediation, people settle their cases on the eve of trial all the time in some way or another. They do. And it's always best if you can settle your case and not leave it to a court. You have much more control if you are the decision makers rather than the court.
Is there anything improper or illegal with one party offering a financial incentive to the other party to obtain relocation?
No, and I actually have negotiated that in the past.
Now,
and since that time as well.
Subsequent to that hearing, did you have another mediation on the dissolution, the distribution of assets, and the parenting time?
We did. And at that mediation, we came very close to settling it, and we were there for quite a long period of time. But we did not settle it at the mediation. I think we settled it within a week after the mediation, where opposing counsel and I exchanged a lot of phone calls, and because we had gotten very, very close at mediation, and we were able to resolve all of it within a week of mediation.
Now,
before we had a court hearing trial set, I believe, and so we were able to do it before the court trial.
Thank you. Prior to adjourning mediation, did an issue come up concerning a potentially non-marital asset that Ms. Adelson had?
It did.
And what asset was that?
It was the, if I remember correctly, it was the Charles Schwab account that we had listed on the financial affidavit in the marital portion. And then on the non-marital portion, we had listed Charles Schwab non-marital portion to be determined. And we went into mediation in that way, not knowing exactly what was marital and what was non-marital.
Now, I know in our pretrial discussions, you indicated, can you typically talk about what happens at mediation?
Mediation is confidential, and that's one of the things I tell my clients, is that the mediator can't be called to testify about what happened in mediation, and I can't testify about what happened in mediation, et cetera, et cetera. So the theory behind that is that people will be as open to negotiation without fear that it's going to come back in court and hurt them in some way in front of a judge. You can't talk about the settlement offers that were made. For example, in mediation, if they say, oh, but he offered to pay child support above and beyond child support, and then we don't reach an agreement, you can't come into court and say, but he made this offer. So it keeps everybody moving forward and not worrying about what the offers are.
Is there an exception for disclosing what happens in mediation if you're ordered to do so by the court?
There is. And there's also an exception about what happens in mediation if the marital settlement agreement is asked to be set aside for some purpose, like fraud or overreaching or something like that, then the terms of it and the mediation would potentially be able to pierce that veil of confidentiality.
But for our purposes, in order to talk about what specifically happened concerning that asset in mediation, do you need the court to order that you disclose that information?
I would certainly like the court to order that. I don't want to fall foul of any mediation rules. I can tell you that my client has waived that confidentiality. The mediator, who was a friend and a lovely person, Joe Boyd, he is not with us anymore. And Professor Markell is not with us anymore. So a lot of people in that mediation are gone. And Ms. Adelson has waived confidentiality.
You need to do the punch. With the waiver of confidentiality by your client, I will order you to testify on the subject matters being inquired into. The state may cross-examine as to all subjects as well. You may continue.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Ms. Adamson, can you tell us that Charles Schwab account that you mentioned, how was that addressed at mediation?
So this became sort of a last-minute little dust-up during the mediation. So what we did was we called the Charles Schwab account representative. And this is not uncommon in mediation. And I had Joe Boyd, who was the mediator, come in and talk to the Charles Schwab account representative. So it wasn't just me talking to the representative and telling the other side what had happened. I wanted the mediator to actually do it and to hear it. And so he talked to the Charles Schwab representative, who outlined, in his opinion, what the possessory status of that Charles Schwab account was, who owned it when, where it was, how it had been separated into multiple accounts, apparently, and which ones were marital and non-marital. And then he went into the other room. We're not in the same room. We're in... Ms. Adelson and I are in one room, and Professor Markell and his lawyer are in another room, and the mediator is going back and forth between the two rooms. So in our room, he listened to the what the Charles Schwab representative said, and then he went into the other room and told them what he had said. And after that mediation, Mr. Duggar and I discussed the fact that it actually happened, and everybody felt comfortable with what was marital and non-marital. And that was when, along with other little things about the parenting and other loose ends being tied up, we were able to actually have a marital settlement agreement. The Charles Schwab account, in all its different permutations, was listed in the marital settlement agreement. And Professor Markell had he had almost $500,000 worth of non-marital Charles Schwab accounts of his own. So he had non-marital money as well.
So based on what you've discussed, Mr. Markell was aware of the non-marital status of that portion of Wendy Adelson's portion of what she would get.
He was.
Okay. And as you said, shortly thereafter, that case settled?
Within a week, I think. Ish.
Shortly after the divorce was final, did Wendy invite you to get her groove back party?
I don't remember when the party was, whether it was a month or two or three, but she did invite me to a party in her new, I think it was a apartment or townhouse, I don't remember what it was exactly, but she invited me to a party. It was called Wendy Gets Her Groove Back, and I had several friends I knew of Wendy's that were there as well, and it was just sort of a Wendy's in a good place, come celebrate my new life party. Yeah, in Tallahassee.
Okay. Throughout the course of your representation, could you tell us total amount of attorney's fees and costs that you incurred in this case?
I think the total amount of costs and attorney's fees, we did take a couple depositions. We had two mediations. One was ordered by the court on that relocation case, and then that was a pretty short mediation. It was only a couple hours. The other one was much longer. I think the total attorney's fees were probably about $30,000.
And costs of...
That includes costs and everything, I think.
Okay. Now,
I know that sounds like a lot, but it wasn't that much compared to a lot of litigated cases.
Okay. Now, litigated cases have multiple evidentiary hearings.
Correct.
Did this?
No, we had no. I don't believe we actually had any evidentiary hearings. The only other hearing that we really did have was post-dissolution.
So aside from the relocation, prior to the divorce being final, there were no contested hearings?
There were no contested hearings.
Now, subsequent, did the marital settlement agreement require that Mr. Markell pay Wendy and yourself certain sums?
So, according to the marital settlement agreement, Professor Markell kept the house. So he was supposed to pay Wendy for her part of the house. And all the other assets were divided equally so that he kept an equal amount, she kept an equal amount. He was supposed to pay, I think it was about $120,000 for his part of the house within 60 days. He had the money because he had more than $500,000 in non-marital assets, and he had also marital assets as well. He was supposed to pay me $10,000 in attorney's fees because he made a lot more money than Wendy did, and it's based upon, attorney's fees is based upon who has more resources, and he had considerably more resources than we needed. So that was part of the agreement. He was supposed to pay me $10,000. He was supposed to pay her $120,000, all within 60 days of the agreement, which was July sometime, 2013.
July 31st?
I think that's right.
Did Mr. Markell pay the sums that he was obligated to pay under the settlement agreement?
He was supposed to transfer, if I remember, from one of his Charles Schwab accounts to Wendy, the money. He gave her $50,000 of the $120,000 in a pretty timely basis, and then he just didn't pay the rest. And I don't like to file enforcement hearings on things like that because it takes a long time to get to court. It's not fun. It's just kind of, so I was pretty much once a week or once every other week asking opposing counsel if Professor Markell was going to pay.
Did he pay?
He did not.
What did you have, what did Wendy ask you to do to enforce that?
At some point, I wrote a letter, I believe, to opposing counsel. So this was, you know, first it's a bunch of emails and phone calls, and then it's a letter saying, please, please pay. So we don't have to file an enforcement. A part of our marital settlement agreement, if we have to file an enforcement and we win, which we would have because he had to pay, then he would also have to pay additional attorney's fees for doing that. So then it just becomes more and more money that he's owes and he's not paying theoretically. So, and this was all on property issues. So unlike custody, we're not going to be able to, or child support, we can't put him in court or in jail. We're not going to be able to put him in jail or anything like that. We're only going to have to be able to go after his assets and things of that nature. It's a lot easier if people will just pay. So I finally filed a motion for enforcement saying he'd only paid $50,000. He owed the other money and he owed me money. And I asked for a court hearing on all of that.
Sounds like it was pretty straightforward motion that you filed.
It was pretty straightforward. It was probably four or five paragraphs.
Okay. Did that prompt Mr. Markell to pay?
No, it did not.
What happened?
So then Mr. Markell hired a new lawyer. And his new lawyer filed a responsive pleading to that my motion, basically saying that he shouldn't have to pay because Ms. Adelson had breached the marital settlement agreement.
How did he allege that she breached the settlement agreement?
He filed multiple motions, but this first responses and motions, his first one, basically, if I remember correctly, was all about the money. And he said that he shouldn't have to pay because she had hidden the Charles Schwab money from him. And he used to have power of attorney, so he knew that she hid the money, which doesn't make sense because if he had power of attorney, he would know what the money was. So it didn't make sense to me. But anyway, that she had hidden that money, and that she hadn't told him about several other of her retirement accounts, and therefore the marital settlement agreement was breached and he shouldn't have to pay her the money.
So you filed a response, but did he seek to have the settlement agreement itself voided or set aside?
He did not. So, and that is what I told Wendy at the time, is that is not a proper defense for not paying the money. Professor Markell, it was pretty obvious that he had actually written this pleading himself, and the lawyer just signed off on it. It had footnotes, which is not something litigation lawyers would do. It was voluminous, and it was very personal about what was going on and Wendy and how he, I don't think at this point he alleged that, he might have alleged that she had committed fraud. But an appropriate pleading would have been for him to file a 12.540. I know it's kind of technical, but basically if you think that an agreement is reached and it is not in good faith, or there's assets that were not provided, then you must file within a year for a 12.540 to have the whole agreement set aside. You can't just say one good breach is another. And I filed a pleading basically saying that his motion should be dismissed because it was inappropriate. And
you filed a motion to strike as a sham pleading?
I did. I filed a motion saying this was an inappropriate pleading and it should be dismissed. Because it was. It wasn't the correct way to go about doing what he wanted to do. And so I then tried to set hearings on those motions so that we could move this forward and everybody could get paid.
Now, in the process of doing this with his responses, did he file subsequently a pleading that further alleged fraud on Wendy's part?
I think he filed at least one or two more pleadings that did that.
And before we get to the final one, that, mm-hmm. You advised Ms. Adelson along the way of what you just told us about the unlikelihood of his success.
I did not think he was going to be successful in his response because it was an inappropriate pleading and it should have been dismissed, which I believe it would have been dismissed. And you can't say, I'm not going to pay you because you breached this agreement by not giving me documents. That just, first of all, there's a lot of case law that says that if a case is heavily involved with mediations and lawyers and all these documents have been produced, you had your shot at it. So he was not going to be able to do that. Plus, I knew that he knew about these assets because we had that conversation at mediation, and I had several conversations with his lawyer afterwards, and the marital settlement agreement listed all these assets that he was claiming he had no knowledge of, and they were already listed on the marital settlement agreement. So it was not, in my opinion, a successful response, and I told Wendy that it wasn't, and not to worry about it.
Now, there was a hearing in February of 2014. I think the records indicate that that Mr. Markell and his attorney were attempting to depose Ms. Adelson.
So what happened was I wanted to take his deposition so I could find out why he wasn't paying. And their response was to want to take her deposition, which I did not believe was appropriate because we were simply trying to enforce a marital settlement agreement, and there's nothing that would happen in terms of that marital settlement agreement that would require him to ask her any questions. So I did file a motion to protective order so that he would not take her deposition. We went to court on that issue in front of the same judge.
And what happened at that hearing?
At that hearing, which we did not have transcribed, which we usually do, but we didn't because it was pretty much a 15-minute hearing, the judge read all of the pleadings, and she said that she was very unhappy with Professor Markell's pleadings. She did not like them. She thought they were poking my client's eye, and they were not appropriate, and she never wanted to see pleadings like this in front of her again, but she was going to allow the deposition.
With some limits?
With limits, yes.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly all the limits, but they could only be about certain things.
Now, subsequent to that, did Mr. Markell file an additional pleading concerning complaints that he had about right of first refusal, parenting time, and things of that nature?
So that's the first time, and this is actually almost a year after the divorce, and we're done with the whole divorce. That's the first time that he brought up any parenting issues. And it was a series of issues that he had now about the parenting. And it was that Wendy wasn't allowing him to FaceTime with his children as much as he wanted to, that they weren't allowed to go to the same, be present at the same birthday parties, that if there was a birthday party that he was at, she wouldn't come, things like that. And that that she wasn't, I think there was a right of first refusal in it, and that she was having, letting her mom watch the kids, and she didn't, he didn't like her mom watching the kids. And I think he alleged that her mom was saying bad things to the kids, potentially about him. I think that was and that was the first time. He also, I think it was that pleading where he went on a little bit more about Wendy and how she should probably be disbarred from the practice of law, and that I should be disbarred from the practice of law. I think it was that one.
As he's filing these things, are you still trying to set a hearing, or set the depositions and set hearing on your enforcement motion?
I've still been trying to do that. There were a number of hearings that got canceled. Some of them, I think, were because of the court needed to move things. Some of them because I was trying to work this out still. I'm always trying to work out a case and not go to court if I can. So we were trying to work it out, but he wasn't paying, and I was trying to set hearings on all of this so we could get the money and we could get his motions dismissed because they were frivolous.
Okay. Now, the one motion concerning his my client, Mrs. Adelson, he referenced parental alienation. Have you dealt with parental alienation in your practice before?
I have.
And what is that?
Well, it's not actually a recognized legal term, and it's not actually a recognized mental health term by the mental health professionals, but it does happen. I mean, we all know that there are parents who do alienate their children against their spouse by saying really terrible things or trying to put up roadblocks to parentings. And I've had cases that were pretty serious in the past where little children, it doesn't usually impact teenagers. By the time they're teenagers, they've already done they want to do their teenage thing. It really truly impacts not children this young either. It's usually like 7 to 9 year olds that we deal with when we have parental alienation, where they've completely aligned with one parent inappropriately. And not because the other parent is doing something like abusing them or something like that. It's because the other parent truly is putting up these roadblocks. They do use those terms. I've seen it.
Okay. The statements that were included in the March 26, 2014 pleading filed by Mr. Markell that were attributed to my client, would that have resulted in any sort of relief preventing my client from having any sort of unsupervised time with the grandchildren?
No. It's not possible. And I told Wendy that.
Okay. Now, as Professor Markell continued filing things, did you realize that you were going to have to become a witness?
So I can't remember how many pleadings he filed on that regard. It may have been 3. And it was the last one that he filed, I believe it was in May, I believe, where he said that, where he became very personal to me, which occasionally happens. It doesn't usually happen with professional people, so I was surprised, but he became very personal towards me and said that I had committed fraud and that I should be disbarred based upon what had happened. At that point in time, I knew that I was going to actually have to be a witness now in this case. And as a witness, you can't be a witness and a lawyer representing your client. So I knew that I had to withdraw. So I withdrew so that I could testify in the case that was going to come up. And I sought a new counsel for Ms. Adelson at that point.
Did that result in the hearing that had, now, let me back up. Had you been able prior to withdrawing to schedule the hearing on your enforcement motion as well as Mr. Markell's motions?
I had it scheduled. It was scheduled, but then I had to withdraw because he filed that pleading after it was scheduled. So I had to withdraw, and I called Jimmy Judkins and asked him if he could please represent Ms. Adelson. He said yes, but he needed more time to get up to speed on that case, so the hearing had to be moved.
Okay. And around this time, were you aware that Mr. Markell had to change counsel again as well?
I did not know that.
Were you aware that as Mr. Markell is filing these pleadings, including the one in March, that he continued to ask my client to watch the children during his time sharing?
I don't know what they were. I don't know anything about their correspondence. I've really only dealt with Wendy.
And on that note, we discussed earlier that it's not unusual for parents or family to be involved in meetings. Was my client, Donna Adelson, involved in any of the meetings that you had with Wendy Adelson during her initial dissolution proceeding or any of the enforcement proceedings after the fact?
She was not involved in any. I never spoke to her except for the one hearing on relocation that she and her husband came to. But even then, it was very brief. They were very nice, lovely people. I didn't, even after the, even afterwards, I didn't, they were fine. I had no issues with them, but I never spoke to them. I never emailed with them. They never came to any meetings. They were not involved with me.
And do you have a recollection of whether my client and her husband were in the courtroom for the relocation hearing, or were they out in the hallway?
I believe they were in the hallway. I don't believe they came in.
Okay, just a moment, Your Honor.
Nothing further this time?
Cross-examination.
Morning.
Good morning.
So you said you weren't you weren't aware of Donna Adelson's involvement.
She was not involved with me.
Okay.
So no.
Did you know that she was drafting Wendy's filings and having Wendy copy and paste them to send to you?
She couldn't have drafted any of the filings because I drafted the filings.
What she would like to be put in the filings, how about that?
I'm not aware of any of that, no.
Okay. Do you know that she was drafting things for Wendy to put in her filings in Wendy's voice?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Did Wendy, though, give you input on things maybe to put in filings or things that she would like said on her behalf?
Not a lot. I talked to Wendy on a pretty regular basis when I was filing something on the phone or by email. And she was a very good client, in all honesty, where she listened to me and she basically, we have clients that don't. Now we have clients that give you ChatGPT and want you to do ChatGPT pleadings, you know, so there's that. She wasn't that client. She would say something like, well, and my pleadings were very short. I mean, my pleadings were very, very short. They were to the point and like, no, dismiss this. That's not true. There wasn't a lot more going on in most of them.
So you wouldn't have knowledge of Wendy sending pleadings to her mom and saying, let's edit this?
No, because I wouldn't have edited it based on that anyway.
Okay.
I mean, maybe they did, but I didn't do it.
All right.
And I never heard about it.
Okay. So this would have been between Donna and Wendy.
If that happened, yeah.
You mentioned that, of course, she had a shot with relocation, but given the situation in this case being that the kids were raised in Tallahassee, the parents' jobs with FSU, you were not personally surprised when the relocation was denied.
I'm never surprised when a relocation is denied.
Because it's hard to prove detriment at that time.
I'm always hopeful, you know, but,
right.
And I thought she had a good shot or I wouldn't have let her do it. I mean, I'm not going to file a frivolous motion, and I thought she had a good shot for a number of reasons.
Regardless, though, of what you think, do you ever have clients or family members of clients who have unrealistic expectations of what the courts will allow or what you can do for them?
Yes.
Okay. Even given your best guidance?
Yes.
Okay. And that's not an uncommon thing.
No. That's why parents are often involved in these cases and come to talk to me about what they think I should be doing. Yes, I get that a lot.
Right. And at that relocation hearing, were Donna and Harvey Adelson possible witnesses?
You know, I've been trying to think about that. I think that that's probably why I had them sit outside, is because
right.
they could potentially be witnesses and invoking the rule. However, I think we had come to either the close of our case.
But you wouldn't know that until
Right.
You were done calling witnesses.
Correct. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So that's why they were in the hallway.
That's why they were in the hallway, yeah.
Okay. Not because they didn't care or they weren't involved.
Oh, no. They were very nice. I mean, I met them. They were there when I got there in the morning. They introduced themselves. They were very nice. We did our thing. I came back and told them afterwards. Nobody yelled or screamed or cried or did any carrying on, which sometimes happens. So, no, it was all very appropriate.
Okay. Do you sometimes have clients or family members of clients who take the news harder than you do when they lose something in court?
Well, I don't like to lose either. So there's that. I don't like it. That's why I don't like to go to court if I think I'm going to lose. That's why I want to settle things. But sometimes they take it really hard, especially family if they're not there. They do.
Okay. And you said Wendy was upset when she was denied the relocation, but she was calm. Oh, let me also ask you this. Wendy Adelson stipulated to the denial of the relocation after you found out behind the scenes from the judge that it was going to be denied.
Correct.
Okay. And she was upset about it, but calm.
Yes.
She's not screaming.
No.
No, okay.
And I have people do that. I mean, I've had to have my own clients taken by the bailiff out.
I'm sure you've seen it all. And how did Donna Adelson feel about not winning the relocation?
I don't know how she felt. I can only tell you that I came out, I talked to Wendy, and then briefly, as far as I remember, because I mean it was 13 years ago, I think I talked to all of them and kind of told them what happened and what was going on. And, you know, I didn't agree with the judge, but this is the judge, and I get to make the decisions. And I think that Wendy went and talked to her parents without me and then came back and said, okay, we're good. We can go into court and we can stipulate.
Okay.
Which is what I had suggested.
So if there are emails of Donna Adelson being upset about and very disappointed and about it being denied or unhappy with your representation for some reason, that's not something she's telling you to your face?
No.
Okay. You talked about Dan Markell not paying what he was supposed to pay according to the settlement agreement. In Dan Markell's court filings, did he give, and I know you don't agree with those reasons, but did he give his reasons for not paying?
He gave his reasons,
okay.
Yes.
And that included the fact of that he was accusing Wendy of noncompliance.
That's true.
Okay. Eventually, did you seek to have Dan Markell held in contempt of court?
I did. It was part of my motion was to have him held in contempt of court and enforce it. That's not the kind of contempt where I can throw him in jail.
Yeah, what does that mean, contempt of court? Can you explain that?
So in a child support hearing or an alimony support hearing, if someone doesn't pay their child support or their alimony, we can have someone held in contempt of court and put in jail if we can prove they had the ability to pay, but they're just not paying, and then the court can put them in jail until they pay the amount they're supposed to pay, okay, because they have it. If it's a property issue, we can't really have them held in contempt of court because it's a property issue. And that was part of why Dan's pleadings didn't make a lot of sense, because he was mixing up property and child issues, and you can't do that. It's strictly property or it's kid issues. In a property issue, that it would be a multi-step thing to have him held in contempt of court. He would basically, the judge would have to find that he was not paying, he's willfully not paying.
Could I ask you a different question?
Okay.
I'm sorry.
But even in a property situation, the court could put him in jail ultimately, but it would be multiple steps I would have to go through. It wouldn't be just one step, and it would be difficult.
What ultimately is the consequence of that is my question.
So ultimately, the ultimate consequence is we would probably get a final judgment against him for the amount that was owed.
Like a lien.
And a lien against, and we could possibly, we would get a lien against the house, and we would, and I have to do this often, I would send them to a debt collector attorney who would then have to file another suit to be able to collect that money, and then they would probably be able to go into his assets and get the assets. So it's a multiple stage process which is why I just wanted him to pay the money and not make me do this.
So if it was successful, probably a lien. Worst case scenario, he could go to jail. And then him being an attorney, though, could he lose his bar license, possibly, if he's held in contempt of court, or at least be in trouble with the bar?
He could. I've had lawyers held in contempt of court over these issues before. I haven't had one lose their license yet.
Okay.
But they could. It is a possibility.
Did you inform Wendy Adelson that you were seeking to have him held in contempt?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I probably did. Because it's kind of a generalized form. It's a motion for contempt and enforcement.
Okay. And then at some point, did he allege that Wendy Adelson should be held in contempt?
I don't know if contempt, I don't know if, I can't remember if he actually said she could be, should be held in contempt legally the way that I was using it. I think his pleadings were much more, Wendy should be disbarred.
Okay.
I mean, that's what he specifically said.
Right.
That she was committing fraud and she should be disbarred.
Would you describe this divorce as contentious?
I wouldn't describe the divorce as particularly contentious at all compared to most of the divorces I had. I mean, we settled it. I don't settle a lot of my cases where we actually go to week-long trials over things of that nature. I think it was like any divorce where there were ups and downs of moments where it was contentious and not fun. But for the most part, we kind of settled it. We settled it after mediation, and it wasn't a problem. I do think that this whole issue of the enforcement got a little contentious. I really didn't understand it because he paid the first $50,000 fine. And then all of a sudden, he decided not to pay the rest. And I didn't really get it and know why he was doing that because the parenting stuff didn't come up for like several months afterwards. So none of what he was doing made sense. I think he just got upset with Wendy or something. I don't know what it was.
Okay. Thank you for that information. It wasn't contentious, but you did say that his motions were very personal. His pleadings were very personal.
That's where I think it became contentious is
and
when he did that.
Was that personal attacks on both Wendy Adelson and you?
Correct.
And he was alleging that Wendy Adelson committed fraud, right?
Yes.
He's alleging you committed fraud.
I did.
It got so bad that you had to get off the case so that you could be a witness on Wendy Adelson's behalf, right?
Correct. That's happened before, though. I mean, I've had that happen before.
And he alleged Wendy should be disbarred, you said.
Correct.
And he's having issues with Wendy's mom, Donna Adelson, even being able to watch the kids, is what you said in one pleading.
One of the pleadings said something about the right of first refusal that he had, and she shouldn't be allowed to have the kids unsupervised, I think, during right of first refusal because she was saying things about him to the kids, he thought.
And did the litigation between Dan Markell and Wendy Adelson continue even after you got off the case?
Once I got off the case, it was the end of June, and I think that he was gone within a few weeks after that.
So you were supposed to be a witness on Wendy Adelson's behalf, right?
Correct.
Were you ever able to have that hearing?
No.
Why not?
Because I got a call from Jimmy Jenkins when I was in Tampa at something that he was dead. It was pretty shocking.
Does that happen very often in your divorces?
That does not. We've had a few people get murdered, and I've had a few suicides. Okay. But it's rare, and I remember all of them.
Right. But not contentious.
Sometimes, I don't know with the suicides, you know. I don't know.
Okay. That's all.
Thank you.
Redirect examination.
Briefly, Your Honor. First witness.
You may.
Yes, I'll sit. I'm going to approach and show you
I'm sorry. states the watch with A, I think it's quoted to 1, page 441 of the demonstrative. And then I'll hold in 454 if you can hold that.
Sure.
Please.
Okay.
Is that.
Okay.
Is that the March 26, 2014 pleading that Mr. Martel filed?
It appears to be.
Can you turn to 454 that I had tapped?
Yes.
Is that the prayer for relief for that motion?
Yes.
Can you direct your attention to the portion that reflects my client's, Donna Adelson's time with the children? Does that reflect that Mr. Markell was asking that my client's unsupervised time with the children not interfere with his right of first refusal?
I think you're talking about paragraph 6, where it says, enjoin the former wife from allowing the maternal grandmother to have unsupervised time with the children consistent with the right of first refusal. That was that right of first refusal.
Yes.
And to impose appropriate limitations to safeguard the children from being subjected to disparaging comments about their father.
Ms. Adamson, did you testify that the divorce was not contentious, but some of his pleadings post-divorce were contentious?
I think that's accurate.
Okay. And that his pleadings were personal. He essentially he attacked both Wendy Adelson and yourself.
Correct.
Okay. Is that what caused you to withdraw?
I'm very used to personal attacks. I've had a lot of personal attacks. The only reason, and I'm fine with that, the only reason that I withdrew is because I was going to be a witness, not because I cared what he said about me.
Had Mr. Markell not included in his pleadings these attacks, would that hearing have gone forward in May of 2014?
If he had not included personal attacks against me that I would have had to testify about, then I would have continued with the hearing.
Now, I want to go back to relocation. After the relocation hearing, my client, Donna Adelson, appeared to accept the court's ruling to you.
As far as I know.
You don't know what she said privately, do you?
I do not.
Concerning Wendy Adelson's involvement in drafting of pleadings, I understood your testimony on cross to be that you'll take input from clients, but ultimately you're the one who is drafting the pleadings.
I take responsibility for my pleadings, and I've never filed a pleading based upon what a client told me I have to do. I will take input because I don't know all the facts. Sometimes I need more facts from them so that I can do it, but I'm ultimately responsible. My name's on those pleadings.
And so you're not going to cut and paste from what a client sends you?
Well, sometimes if they send me really good facts, I'll sort of go, oh, these are good facts, and then I'll take the facts and I'll put them in, but not legal arguments or anything like that, no.
So if you took facts that were provided to you by Wendy Adelson and put those in the factual statements or arguments concerning pleadings or memoranda, the law is still your own writing.
The law is, and I don't really think Wendy, I don't remember that Wendy had much input into any of it, honestly. She wasn't that client. I have clients that are those clients, and she was not that client. I get a lot of ChatGPT now, a lot, telling me what I should be filing.
I don't think you're the only one there, ma'am. Had you not withdrawn to be a witness, the motion would have been heard in May of 2014.
May or June, whenever it was set. I don't remember exactly when it was set.
Okay, if the
whatever the docket says for whenever it was set, yeah.
So if the docket reflects, I think it was May 15th of 2014, the hearing would have gone forward.
Correct.
The judge would have been able to make a decision on all the pending issues.
I believe that's the case.
Nothing further.
Will this witness be recalled?
We'll retain her, but she's free to go about her business.
Thank you.
You may step down. Please call your next witness.
Your Honor, the next witness is Linda Bailey. She could be quite lengthy. I don't know if Your Honor wants to take a brief break.
Do any of you need to take a break or use the restroom? Please raise your hands. A very equivocal wave, but I'll take it. The bailiff will take you to the jury room. Is there a 10:05?
More continuing coverage in the trial of Donna Adelson is coming up from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
'Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Tis the season for identity theft. This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But guess what? Identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss by yourself, even if you keep an eye on your bank and credit card statements. If your identity is stolen, your own U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. And all plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. The last thing you want to do this holiday season is face drained accounts, fraudulent loans, or other financial losses from identity theft all alone. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART. Or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.